missing tonight, but we're glad that you all are here for our singing night and our devotional. And I want to think about Acts 12:7, and I want us to see a similarity that obtains between that passage and what still goes on when someone becomes a Christian. That's the passage that has to do with the angel showing up in Peter's cell and delivering him. And we'll read that in a moment. But I want to begin with some other verses that have to do with man's being dominated by sin. In 2 Timothy 2, there will be a reference made by Paul to Timothy that members of the church that have gone back into sin have been captured according to the devil's will. They've been taken by the devil according to his own will. They're in a captivity. And there are various passages in the New Testament that when they talk about the relationship between a person and sin, when he's a sinner, he's sin dominated. And that's the body of the flesh in Romans chapter 8. The sin dominated, that's why Paul can say, in my body there is no good. He's talking about a sin dominated body. And so it's a very serious thing. In John 8 and verse 34, Jesus said something so fundamental about this. When he's talking to these Jews and he's in a controversy with them, they think they're free people. They're the descendants of Abraham, and these are the free men of God. And down in verse 34, Jesus says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, everyone that commits sin is the bondservant of sin." Now, isn't that something? Everyone that commits sin, that's an active participle. So he's saying everyone that keeps on committing sin, everyone that keeps on practicing sin, he shows you that he's the bondservant of sin. It's almost, and I have heard it referred to this way, as an addiction. If you're thinking about a person who is all of his days dominated by sin, and he keeps on practicing sin, you can look at it like that, like he's addicted to sin. And we know a lot about the use of the word addiction in American culture. There's someone on trial right now in the land that has to, it involves circumstances where there, for a period of time, he was addicted to drugs. Well, could you use that word in regard to a person's sins when he lives in sin? Ephesians 2, Paul will talk about how that the Gentiles, they were in a course of sin. They were practicing sin. Well, we all did at one time. And there's a sense in which it looks like you could even refer to it with some scriptural backing as somewhat of an addiction. That's your constant practice. And then you begin to think, well, then how in the world do you break the cycle? How do you get beyond it? Now go to Romans chapter 6. There are two other passages here that I want to go to that have to do with this relationship between a man and his sin. And in Romans 6:15, Paul says, "What then? Shall we sin because we are not under law but under grace? May it not be so. Know ye not that to whom ye present yourselves as servants unto obedience, his servants ye are whom ye obey." Now here are your choices. Whether of sin, your servants of sin unto death, or your servants of obedience unto righteousness. But thanks be to God that whereas ye were servants of sin, ye became obedient from the heart to that form of teaching whereunto ye were delivered. And being made free from sin, ye became servants of righteousness. What a beautiful thought and contrast between what they became when they obeyed the gospel of Christ with what they had been when they were still practicing sin. Now, the last passage in this part of the lesson that I want us to look at is 1 John 3. And in 1 John chapter 3, verse 7, "My little children, let no man lead you astray. He that doeth righteousness is righteous, even as he is righteous," or Jesus is righteous. "He that doeth sin is of the devil, for the devil sinneth from the beginning." Now, in this passage, you have this word. It's a present active participle. It's the one doing this. The one doing righteousness. He's righteous. The one doing sin or doing evil, well, he's of the devil. And it's a participle. The one that keeps on doing this. The one that keeps on doing this. So again, we have passages that show the difference between the relationship of a sinner to his sin as a practitioner and a saint, a child of God, who has broken the cycle by the grace of God and is not continuing to practice sin. Even though back in chapter 1 of 1 John, now John says, now we do have to say we commit momentary acts of sin. And he says, and if you won't admit that, you're lying. And you're making God a liar. And the truth is not in you. So that's a big distinction with John. I have to say, as a Christian, somebody says, "Mac, you ever commit sin?" Well, of course. And John said, if I said I didn't, I'd make God a liar, I'd be a liar, and the truth would not be in me. But over here in chapter 3, he makes this distinction between me and a person in the world. The man that keeps on practicing sin, he's of the devil. The man that keeps on doing or practicing righteousness, he's like Jesus in that regard. And that's a very important point. Now in John 3... In John 3, there is one more passage. I said that would be it right here at this part of the lesson, but there is one more. Back in John 3 and verse 21, Jesus had said this. Now, this is after his conversation. It possibly could still be a part of his conversation with Nicodemus, but anyway, it's in that context. Verse 20, "For everyone that doeth or keeps on doing evil hateth the light and cometh not to the light, lest his works should be reproved." Now, isn't that something? It's the same word that's used in 1 John 3, 7 and 8. It's the one doing it, the one who keeps on doing it. And so he says right here, the one that keeps on doing evil hates the light and comes not to the light. Verse 21, "But he that doeth the truth," the one that keeps on doing the truth, "cometh to the light." He's talking to people before the church is established. But he says in John chapter 1, John reports, Jesus is the light. Jesus is the light. "He that doeth the truth cometh to the light, that his works may be made manifest, that they have been wrought in God." Amazing. Now, I want us to go to Acts 12 and read that passage again. And then I want us to note some similarities that obtain between what happened in this one little capsule of a verse. Now, most verses you can't treat like this, but this one you can. "And behold, an angel of the Lord stood by him," by Peter, "and a light shined in the cell. And he smote Peter on the side and awoke him, saying, Rise up quickly. And his chains fell off from his hands." Now the title of this lesson is, "And the chains fell off." And the chains fell off. And I want you to just look at that passage as I make 5 points because of what is said in those few words. When God delivers someone, See, Peter here is in desperation, and we've already talked about how that he had his composure and he was sleeping away and he wasn't worried about anything, and this is in the aftermath of the murder of James. But he's not worried. Evidently, he's got confidence in God. And regardless of what happens, if he lives, he lives. If he dies, he dies. If he lives, like Paul says, it's Christ living in me. If I die, it's my gain. I get to go on. And I tell you what, it takes some age, I think, for a Christian to get to where he can really appreciate that point. It takes a little bit of age before you can experience the kind of feeling of that. If I live, fine, but if I die, wonderful. Wonderful. If I die, it's gain. It's gain. So this is a deliverance. This is a deliverance. What happens when God delivers someone? Now, there are five things he said right there. And they still happen. They still happen. Number one, someone from God shows up. Now just think about that. When God delivered Daniel from the lion's den, or his friends from the fire, or whoever you talk about, when he delivers someone from some sort of malady or desperation, he sends someone. Somebody shows up. And every time someone really becomes a Christian, in his life, someone has shown up. Maybe it was a parent. We would hope in a lot of cases that would be the case. Sadly, in many cases, parents don't help. And maybe it was someone he ran into at work or someone he ran into at school. Maybe he was invited to go with some neighbor children to Bible class. But whatever, however the deliverer, maybe a missionary in a foreign field. Maybe he just saw a sign by the side of the road. Maybe he stopped by because he needed help. And then he starts to investigate something later. But every time someone is delivered by God, it's because somebody somehow shows up. In this passage, it's an angel. Whenever you have the word angelos transliterated, it comes into the English text as angel. It's just a transliteration. The word itself means, if you want to translate it, it means messenger. So sometimes the messengers are angels, as the context shows. In Exodus 3, the messenger was one of the Godhead himself. It wasn't an angel at all, but it was a messenger. But it was a member of the Godhead. Well, take off your shoes, Moses. The ground whereon you stand is holy ground. An angel doesn't make ground holy. God does. So you can have the word angel used when it's a reference to deity. You can also have it used as a reference to a messenger sent from deity. In Genesis 18, three men show up at the Oaks of Mamre, where Abraham was living with his wife Sarah. And two of those men were messengers from God, and one of those men was God. Evidently, as we see by his refusal to go into Sodom. But the angels went in. In Isaiah 6:8, God is talking to Isaiah. And Isaiah says, "Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?' Then said I, 'Here am I. Send me.'" Now, preachers have used that a lot of times in sermons, talking about, you know, how that we need to be accessible to God and let God use us to his glory in his own way. And we must have a willingness of spirit to be utilized on this earth. We can't be an Isaiah. And we can't be a Paul. And we can't be like Daniel. We can be ourselves, but we can make ourselves available. Here am I. Just use me however you can, in what ways you can. I want to be useful. He used Abraham, when the time came, when the time was right, there was Isaac and Jacob. There was Moses. When Moses went off, there was Joshua. We had Noah. We had David. We had Daniel, Job. We had John the Baptizer. We had Jesus. Whenever some new epoch or new move needed to be made in the scheme of redemption, as God was getting the whole thing wrapped up and ready to show to mankind, when He needed a certain person, He was there. By the providence of God, He was there. And it's still that way in the providence of God. When deliverance is given, it's because someone shows up from God. God always helps. And I should be always in my life oriented, just like Simon Peter. God can do with me now what He wants to. I didn't choose to be here, but I am here. I don't like this circumstance, but it is my circumstance. Now I just choose to be useful, and I don't want to worry. I want to live by faith and die by faith. I want to live victoriously. I want to die victoriously. It's no big deal now which way it goes. I desire God's help. I know I need God's help. I should live my life with the expectation of God's help. Now that's where faith comes in. I know I need help. Jeremiah 10:23. I know I seek help. Personal experience. And I know by faith I expect God to keep on helping me as He always has every day of my life. I'm not looking for a sign. I'm looking for wisdom that will allow me to see the solution to my problem. Jesus had people, show us a sign, give us a sign. I'm not looking for a sign. I've got plenty of signs right here. And I've got plenty of history, and just like all of you do, in the providence of God, taking care of us all of our lives. We don't have enough words to express our gratitude. So, someone all shows up when God makes delivery. Or deliver someone. Point two. Every time there's a deliverance, light is provided. Of some sort. Somehow. May not be a physical light, but light of some sort. And that's a good thing. The Old Testament, Genesis 1:3, God said, let there be light. I mean, the book just starts off so early with the concept. Then a few verses later, He makes two great lights. The greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. And He made the stars also. All these huge lights. And then John in 1 John will say, God is light. In Him is no darkness at all. And then in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, just a moment ago, Paul was talking about how that the brethren are light. You're sons of light. You're not walking in darkness. Sinners live in darkness. He uses illustrations of sleeping and getting drunk. But he says, we're not like that. Spiritually speaking, we're people of the day. Spiritually speaking, we're people who walk in light. And in that cell, when the one showed up from God, a light shined. A light shined in the cell. Go to 1 Timothy 6, if you will. 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul's first epistle to his young cohort, Timothy. We go to the last chapter, chapter 6, verse 16. Now, he's talking here just about the Father. The words show that. The potentate, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, is not Jesus in this passage, it's the Father. In the book of Revelation, chapter 21, it's Jesus Himself. This again shows the oneness of God. So He says in verse 15, which in its own times He shall show, He is God the Father, who is the blessed and only potentate, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who only hath immortality, dwelling in light unapproachable, whom no man hath seen nor can see, to whom be honor and power eternal. Amen. Now that's kind of reminiscent. the description, like Moses coming down on Sinai and his face shining so brightly, the people said, Moses, we can't look at you. We can't look at you. Because he was reflecting the glory of God. Now he says the glory of God, talking about from the standpoint of people living on the earth, he said that we can't approach that. I suppose there's a big change in 1 John 3:2 when you get to be like Jesus. When Jesus comes, we're going to see him as he is because we're going to be like him. And when you're like him, just like him, you can see the Father. His face is no longer unapproachable. Isn't that something? But now, right now, to me on the earth, if I were to come in his presence physically and he's spirit, spiritually, it would be blinding. But by the time I get to glory, my condition will be such that I can look at his face. He's approachable now because I am in the condition of ultimate glory itself. That's an amazing thing. In John 1, 4, and 5, in the beginning was God, was the Word, and the Word was God. The Word was with God, the Word was God. And down in verse 5, we see that the Word was, Jesus is life. He's light, he's the light of life. And the word there for light is the word phos. There are several Greek words for light. And you have to be very, very careful about trying to make any stark distinctions because they're used in various ways. There seems to be quite an overlapping of some of these words. But this word phos, we get our word phosphorescent. This is phos. From the Hebrew, the light of God's presence, it can be. It can be divine light or perfect light, perfect brightness. And this is the word that's used in 1 John 1:5, where God is light. And Jesus is light in 1 John 1, 4 and 5. Now in John 5:35, where Jesus is discussing John the Baptizer, he says John was a light. But he uses a different word there. And it's for a portable light, one you can carry around. John was a lamp. John was a lamp. It's not really a candle I've seen, but it is a lamp. It's a portable light. And John was a light. And you lived in the light of John's light for a while. But now Jesus makes it clear, that I have greater witness than John. Now John testified, but I've got witness that's not just John. John's from the earth, chapter 3. But I am from heaven, and I have the Father's witness himself in the works that I do. And since Jesus is light and John is light, of course, Jesus is the greater light. Now, and I'm talking about the light in Peter's cell. Light is provided. You see, you can see when he opens his eyes, it's not dark. It's kind of like healing a blind man. John 9. Or telling a man to go wash in the pool of Siloam. He washed and he could see. You open your eyes and it's not dark anymore. You open your eyes and you can see. And when Peter opens his eyes, he can see. Because light is present. And in the New Testament, you've heard me mention this many times, that light stands for enlightenment. Being informed, and it also stands for a purity. We walk in the light. We walk in the truth. 1 John 1:7. We walk in the truth that helps us to stay pure. We don't walk in darkness. We don't do, as Paul would refer in Ephesians, the works of darkness. You know, the people in the world, they do the works of darkness. And he says, they do some things that's even, it would embarrass you to mention them by name. But he says, we're not like that. We're not children of darkness doing works of darkness. We're children of light doing works of light. So we see what we're doing. We see clearly. We see as God would have us to see. Jesus, of course, was recognized when you were around him just for a little while. He was a magnificent teacher. And that was the description that came to be utilized for him by evidently a lot of people. It's the one that Nicodemus himself used in John 3 when he came to Jesus. Rabbi, that word means teacher. Rabbi, we know that thou art a teacher come from God. For no man can do the things which thou doest except God be with him. And Martha, in John 11, when she's telling Mary, Jesus is here, she calls him the teacher. The teacher's here. That's right. You got that exactly right. That's what he was. And that's exactly the case. 2 Peter 1:9, look at this with me, if you will. We're just on the point that when deliverance is given, light is provided. In 2 Peter 1:19, Peter has been discussing his experience on the Mount of Transfiguration. Do you remember that? Mark 9, Matthew 17, Jesus appeared. His garments were changed. His facial expression was changed. There was a brightness, a glory, a majesty, a brilliance about him. And then he starts in this vision talking to two men from the dead that had come back from the grave. And he's been talking about this. And then let's come down and he says, we heard the voice, you know, God said, this is my beloved son, verse 17. And Peter says, the voice we heard, born out of heaven, when we were with him in the Holy Mount. And we have the word of prophecy more sure, whereunto ye do well. Now he's talking to members of the church. Whereunto ye do well to take heed. Take heed to what? To that more sure word of prophecy. As unto a lamp, unto a lamp. I'm telling you, as a light, a lamp shining in a dark place, until the day dawn and the day star rise in your hearts. And then he goes back to that word of prophecy. We know it's inspired of God. Those men wrote, those prophets wrote by the Spirit of God. But he says, you know, we have the Old Testament scriptures, the word of prophecy. That is not only authenticated by its inspiration and by its accuracy, its credentials, internal credentials, but now that Jesus has come and has even talk to men from the dead in the transfiguration scene, you have further proof of the authenticity and the inspiration of the word of prophecy. He says now, he's writing New Testament legislation, which will become a part of the New Testament, last will and testament of Jesus Christ. But the book's not finished yet. But while the book is coming, while the New Testament is coming, you need to pay attention to the word prophecy. As unto a lamp. And he uses the same word there for lamp that Jesus used for John the Baptizer. The same word for light. It's not going to be the final one, the final word. But it's light. It's not darkness. It's light. And you need to pay attention to that. And it's like that Old Testament at that point was like a light in an atmosphere of darkness around it. Isn't that something? But now when the perfect light comes, or when 1 Corinthians 13, when that which is perfect has come, the complete light, it's going to be like the day star. The atmosphere is going to be like day is here. Not a book in the dark, but a book in the day. What a striking contrast between what God was doing in the Old Testament and what he's doing in the last will and testament of Jesus Christ. Number three, right quickly, delivery. What did he do to Peter? That angel, Peter was asleep and he hit him on the side. Attention was obtained. Every time there's a deliverance, somehow, some way, you got to get focused. God has to do something in his providence to bring you to attention. You've got to think. Do you want to think? Do you want the truth? The angel smacks Peter on the side. He smacks him on the side. Do you recognize God's assistance and providence and His help? Haggai chapter 1, His own people, you know, were not living right. They weren't putting Him first in their lives. And Haggai brings that corrective warning to them. And God said, all that time that I wasn't helping you with nature, and it wouldn't rain, He said, didn't you get the point? Didn't you know that I was doing that for you? I was showing you I wasn't pleased with you. And you were just not putting me first, and so I didn't let it rain. And after they straightened up and listened to Haggai and submitted to his will and did what he said about building the temple that was lying out there and had been abandoned, though they had started to repair it, they stopped. And it's just standing out there in disrepair. And once they got back to doing all that, then God changed His program with regard to His weather for them. But He says, you didn't recognize that I was trying to get your attention. Now, I don't know how many ways God uses in His providence, and is doing it now, perhaps on a daily basis throughout the world, trying to bring men to repentance. And trying to get their attention. We don't always think about it. I guess many Christians would, I would think. Many people in the world would not. We would hope that when there is a severe thing like a storm, a tornado, loss of property, loss of life, that it would cause people to lift their eyes to glory and think about what they're doing with their lives. What if they had died that day? How many times is God trying to get somebody's attention until he finally wakes up? How hard does God have to hit somebody? Where does he have to hit him before he can get his attention? A lot of people's attention is never arrested, regardless of what God would have them to see and to do and to become. I need to live in a good way so that I can recognize obvious blessing. I can be strong with obvious adversity. And I could respond favorably to possible chastening. Maybe if there's something in my life that I'm not aware of, but yet God is trying to get my attention, I tell you this, I'm just like you. I want to get better. I want to be better. I want to do better. I want to be stronger. I want to be more useful. I want to be a good example. But God was trying to get Peter's attention, and he did. So, Lord, teach me. Teach me what to know and believe. Teach me what to think. Teach me what to do, how to feel, how to pray, what to expect. You get my attention. Number four, back to Acts 12:7, direction was given. Once he got Peter's attention, Peter, wake up. Peter has to come to it. He's not even sure what the situation is yet. But he starts giving him direction. Starts giving him direction. Rise up quickly. Reminds us of chapter 22. Ananias to Saul. Arise. Get up. Be baptized. Wash away thy sins. Calling on the name of the Lord. Get up, Peter. Get up. Secondly, he said, gird thyself. We talked about that. You know, binding your inner garment, getting up and out of the way. Bind on your sandals. You got to be able to walk. Cast thy outer garment, your garment about you, and follow. Follow me. My, my. Pretty good set of directions right there for a man trying to wake up. But a man living in the darkness of sin. Think of all that's possible and proper to him when God wants him to, I want you to come to faith. I want you to come to repentance. I want you to come to the point where you're willing to stand up and make the good confession and commit your life to the Lord. And I want you to be baptized and enter the kingdom. There are directions, plenty of directions. And the world, even the religious world, still Can't agree on the directions. Still cannot. And so many members of the church, I'm sorry to say, over the years, because of the pressure that they feel, give up on the clarity of recognized directions. It's like I'm supposed to not see that. God didn't really say that. And so we start making up our own rules and regulations for local churches and how people can become Christians and all of that. And we have a fine time in the world. We've got a new kind of fellowship, a new kind of church, and we still try to, ascribe it to God and think we're bound for glory, but the rules we're living by are not the ones He gave. Every time there's deliverance, proper direction is provided. Direction is given. And all that talk about is clothes. You remember when you get to Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 and following, you'll have the armor of God. You got to put on all this armor. Put it all on. Put your helmet on. Put the breastplate on. Put the sandals on your feet. You know, carry your shield. And with all these things, pray. You've got to be properly attired for this war. It's still like that. It still is. So get your attire in order. Follow direction. Follow direction. Number five, the last point, Acts 12:7. He got up, the chains fell off his hands. He was free. They walked right out of that building, or they passed through the wall. They did something. He was free. And finally, out there, he comes within himself, as we talked about that early. He gets clarity of thought regarding reality, and he knows where he is. And he knows, as he says later, God delivered me. God did that. I thought you said there was an angel in there. Well, it was. Where do you think he came from? He came from God. God did that. We need to recognize the goodness of God, the blessings of God, and see God for what He is. Freedom is obtained. John 8:31-32, Jesus said, if you abide in my word, that's the way you continue to be a disciple, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. It's about freedom. You break the cycle of being bound to sin. I don't want to be a bondservant of sin. I don't want to be a slave of sin. I want to be free. Galatians 4:1-7, Paul discusses the Jews and the Gentiles. The Gentiles were in bondage in their past to idols. The Jews were bound under the law. And he said even the Jews, they were just like kids under guardians. They're under stewards. Even heirs. But they're bound. They're bond. They're in bonds. And they don't get free till they come of age, as it were. Well, we've been made free by Jesus Christ. Christ has turned us loose from sin. The guilt, the practice, there's the practice, and the consequence of sin. That's the greatest freedom in all the world. So in chapter 5, verse 1, he will say, for freedom did Christ make you free. What do you think He turned you loose for? He made you free. What for? He wanted you to experience spiritual freedom. You can be in the darkest dungeon in a heathen court with a pagan king and go to glory because of the freedom from sin that you have experienced by the power of Christ, which is better than being just free out here in all kind of luxury on the earth, practicing sin, still being addicted to it. And when you die, you take your sin-stained spirit right into Hades, the portion of it called Tartarus, where the bad people go. And from there, after judgment on the hell, for all the wicked land for eternity. For freedom. In Galatians 5:13, he says, you were called for freedom. Why does he say that to these Galatians? Because Judaizing teachers had come up from Jerusalem and tried to bind the law of Moses on the Gentiles. And Paul in chapter 4 said, well, even Jews under the law of Moses were just like kids under guardians. They didn't have any freedom. And you shouldn't let those Judaizing teachers do that to you. You've already been made free by the gospel of Jesus Christ and by it alone. We are free. What a wonderful thing. But anyway, I think it's just sort of an interesting thing to see how similar what happened in Acts 12:7 is to what happens today when a person becomes a Christian. Someone from God, somehow someone showed up. Light was provided, attention was obtained, direction was given, freedom was obtained.